Welcome to the Southern Festival of Books podcast, brought to you by Humanities Tennessee, an independent affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The Southern Festival of Books is a free public event held each year during the second weekend in October in Nashville. For more information on this and other programs, come check us out on the web at humanitiestennessee.org.
Hey, oh my gosh, this is like a football stadium. So big. Thank you to Sarah Lee and Serenity and everyone here at the festival. Thank you for the Humanities Tennessee and Bookman, Bookwoman. This is just such an incredible festival. Everyone told me, all my writer friends kept telling me, oh, this is going to be the best one. You can't miss this one. So I was thrilled and flattered to be here. I got to tell you, I was standing outside in the courtyard and saw Kate DeCamilla signing. Wow, that was so incredible to see all those children standing in line, so excited to see an author and to have that author sign the book, you know, their favorite book. And I loved looking in their faces, and I couldn't help but think, wow, so much has changed. What a different situation that is from when I was a child, you know, when we had very few, in my mind, very few books, you know, to choose from. Not to mention, you had to get past the librarian if you wanted to check out a book. If you've read Eudora Welty, you'll know that she understood this well before me, and I love it. She wrote, "I never knew anyone who'd grown up in Jackson, Mississippi, without being afraid of Mrs. Calloway, our librarian. She sat with her dragon eye on the door. Silence in big black letters was on signs tacked up everywhere. And if she could see through your skirt, she sent you straight back home. You could just put on a petticoat if you wanted a book that badly from the public library. I was willing, Eudora wrote, because I would do anything to read." Growing up, I've got to tell you, I shared Eudora's madness for books, for reading, and for her intense fear of librarians. Mine wasn't Mrs. Calloway, though. Mine was a woman named Mrs. Kemp, who was my grammar school librarian at First Presbyterian Church Day School. She had beady eyes and unsmiling lips. And I brought her picture just in case you don't believe me. I'll tell you, I was told she was a kind and loving person, but Mrs. Kemp and I had issues. She wouldn't let me check out the books I wanted to. And, you know, there wasn't much to choose from the First Presbyterian Church Day School library anyway. They only had books, you know, with clean, starchy stories, preferably with a good Christian backbone to them, which meant no Pippi Longstocking, no Eloise, because they were not good examples for children to live by. And, you know, oddly enough, nothing with dinosaurs in it, because we were taught that if dinosaurs had existed, they would have been in the Bible. In Mrs. Kemp's library, each grade had a shelf they could choose their books from with colored tape around the edge. And when I was in third grade, I think it was, you know, the yellow tape shelf. I was 9 years old, and I remember being deeply offended by the books they had for me to choose from. You know, delightful books like The Bobbsey Twins and The Littles, Sarah Plain and Tall, and those little orange biographies, you know, about the presidents and the sports heroes in 16-point font. But, you know, after a few months, I had read all of those. And I had my eye over there on the fourth grade shelf because they had Nancy Drew. But every time I asked Mrs. Kemp if I could check out a fourth grade book, she said, absolutely not. And she took to holding up a yardstick when she saw me coming. So finally, fourth grade came, and after about 3 months of school, I consumed everything there was on the shelf. Charlotte's Web, The Cricket in Times Square, which meant by about December, I was eyeing the red shelf where those illicit fifth grade books were. The next year, the problem just got worse as the books got better. Little House on the Prairie, The Chronicles of Narnia. And meanwhile, I was flunking out on multiplication tables and long division because I was dog-earing over and over again every book in the library. But, you know, really, what could I do? I was an addict. And, you know, like any addict looking for that next high, I took to stealing. I stole books out of my older sister's book bag at night after she went to sleep. And let me tell you, Susan was 16 and despicable. She one time tied me to a bedpost for 4 hours while Mother was out shopping. But boy, looking in that book bag paid off. I found V.C. Andrews, Flowers in the Attic, Stephen King, Judy Bloom. I was spellbound. And the more I read, the more I wanted. And, you know, I thought, gosh, if this is what Susan's reading, I can't wait to see what my mother's reading. So I started sneaking books off of her shelf, too. Now, Mother was a divorcee in the 70s, and she was reading Darwin and Gloria Steinem. And I was no genius. I am sure I did not understand most of what I was reading. But I devoured my way through about half of my mother's bookshelf until one day I got caught reading the feminist Erica Jong's Fear of Flying in the library of First Presbyterian Church Day School. I had slipped it inside my library book that I thought I was too smart for. If this was happy on picture day for Mrs. Kemp, you can only imagine her face when she caught me with that book. And I was the first student in our school's history to be expelled from fifth grade. I was thrilled because I thought this meant I could just sit home all day and read. But somehow my mother begged my way back in, and I was forced to go back to fifth grade. And I didn't even bother eyeing the books on the sixth grade shelf. I had ridden in the fast lane, and I knew everything from then on would be a disappointment. I've been told that this renegade attitude about reading and writing comes through in The Help. The Help, if you don't know, is set in my hometown of Jackson, Mississippi, a few years before I was born in 1963. And it is the story of a group of women who truly were renegades, who it's really a story of a young woman who, after she graduates from Ole Miss, moves back home with her parents, you know, the last girl not to be married, and she wants to be a writer. So she starts, you know, to notice things in her friends' homes. You know, they're all married and have husbands and children, and at age, you know, 23 or 24, they already have working full-time in their kitchens black maids. And as Skeeter watches her friends, she starts to notice, you know, little things at first, like the fact that the black help has to keep a separate cup, a separate plate, separate fork in a separate cupboard in the white kitchen. And then bigger things, like the fact that many of her own best friends didn't even pay their maids minimum wage. And, you know, Skeeter grew up with a maid in her house. These were not surprises. But for the first time in her life, it starts to bother her. So she gets an idea. And her idea is to join forces with the black maids in town and to write in secret a tell-all book about what it's really like to work for the white families of Mississippi. It was an incredibly risky project. I didn't even realize it at the time as I was doing my research. But in 1963, it was against the law for blacks and whites to even sit down and discuss racially charged issues. Not to mention, if these black maids had been caught, it would have incurred the wrath of the white women for whom these black maids were working. I want to share with you a little bit about my own inspiration of how the help came to be. Before I was born, my great-great-great-Aunt Carrie hired a second cook in case her first cook died and took all the recipes with her. But as it ended up, Aunt Carrie died first before any of them, and Dimitri, the second cook, was then passed on to work for my grandmother. And Dimitri worked for our family for the next 32 years, from 7 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, 6 days a week. And, you know, I didn't think this was anything out of the ordinary. Everybody in my neighborhood and that I knew and went to school with had a black woman taking care of the children, cleaning up the kitchen, you know, in some cases holding these white families together on a day-to-day basis. I moved to New York when I was 24, and that was the first time I realized I had actually had, like so many of you, a very unique childhood compared to the rest of the world. Dimitri had a profound effect on my life. She went out of her way to make sure that I knew, no matter how things bad got, my parents were divorced, my brothers and sisters were older, and, you know, I was just the tag-along and the leftover. Dimitri used to stand me in front of the mirror and make sure I understood, you are important, you are worth something. What an incredible gift to give a child, and goes so far beyond what any paycheck can cover. I'd like to read a short passage from the book. It's in the voice of the white character, Skeeter, whose maid, Constantine, also had a profound effect on Skeeter's life growing up. The first time I was ever called ugly, I was 13. It was a rich friend of my brother Carlton's over to shoot guns in the field. Constantine found me crying in the kitchen. "Why are you crying, girl?" I told her what the boy had called me with tears streaming down my face. "Now you look a here, Skeeter. Ugly lives up on the inside. Ugly be a hurtful, mean person." Constantine sat down next to me at the kitchen table, and I heard the cracking of her swollen joints. She pressed her thumb hard in the palm of my hand, something we both knew meant listen. You listen to me now. "Every morning until you are dead in the ground, you're going to have to make this decision, Skeeter. You're going to have to ask yourself, am I going to believe what them fools say about me today?" She kept her thumb pressed hard in my hand, and I nodded that I understood. I was just smart enough to realize that for her, she meant white people. And even though I still felt miserable and knew that I was, most likely, ugly, it was the first time she ever talked to me like I was something besides my mother's white child. All my life I've been told what to believe about politics, coloreds, being a girl. But with Constantine's thumb pressed in my hand, I realized I actually had a choice in what I could believe. By 16, I wasn't just not pretty. I was painfully tall, the kind of tall that puts a girl in the back row of class pictures with the boys. The kind of tall where your mother spends her nights taking down hems, yanking at sweater sleeves, flattening your hair for dances you hadn't even been asked to in the first place, finally pressing on the top of your head as if she could shrink you back to the years when she had to remind you to stand up straight. By the time I was 17, mother would rather I suffered from apoplectic diarrhea than stand up straight. She was 5'4" and first runner-up to Miss South Carolina. She decided there was only one thing to do in a case like mine. Mrs. Charlotte Phelan's Guide to Husband Hunting, rule number one. A pretty petite girl should accentuate with makeup and good posture. A tall, plain one with a trust fund. I was 5'11", but I had 25,000 cotton dollars in my name, and if the beauty in that wasn't apparent, then by God, he wasn't smart enough to be in the family anyway. Thanks. I'll tell you, and I've told so many people this, and it really is the truth. When I started writing The Help, I really didn't think anybody was going to read it but me. I wrote it with such abandon and freedom that I think an author can only experience writing their first book. Then when I was told that it was going to be published, I really didn't think anybody outside of Mississippi or maybe even my family would read it. But then a few weeks after the book came out in February, I started getting these emails from readers, and one of the first ones I got was from Rome. Now, I'm from Atlanta. I thought it was from Rome, Georgia. But then I read on, and it was from Italy, and they were telling me that they related to the story of The Help because it made them reflect on some of their own past race and class problems, and it made them appreciate just how much has changed in the world today, changed in such necessary and decent ways. Essentially, they were saying to me, look how far we've come. As of yesterday, The Help has been sold to 29 countries for translation, which is amazing to me because, you know, it was just a little story about my hometown and the relationships, the intimacy that was shared among people, you know, living a few miles away from each other. When the UK bought the rights to The Help, They wanted to put a different cover on it. The Help cover in the United States is yellow, and it has three birds on it. And the point of that is they wanted a cover that said absolutely nothing about the story. But the UK felt like they could be a little more overt and speak to the issue at hand. So this is one of my favorite stories. They sent me a picture. They had gotten it from the Library of Congress, and it is two black maids in white uniforms holding the hand of a little white baby. And they emailed me and said, you know, will you please approve this as our cover? And I said, And I looked down at the bottom. It said Port Gibson, Mississippi, 1940. And I said, well, before I approve it, let me just send it to my friends who live in Port Gibson. So I sent it to my friend Charles, and he sent it to his mother, and said, Mary Jane, who is that little white baby in the cover? And she said, let me look at that. Oh, that's just little Sarah Chrysler going down to Church Street with her two maids. They owned the local newspaper. I was so excited to then email back the UK publisher and say, oh, of course you can use that cover. That's just little Sarah Chrysler on the corner with her maids. The point of that is it is such a small world. There's just not that much difference in Italy, in London, in Jackson, Mississippi. And it's the message, you know, I never wrote The Help with the thought in mind that I wanted to teach anybody a lesson. But if there's one message that I truly believe in as a human being, that is, we are all just people, and not that much separates us. So that is a message I try to pass on to my readers, and I hope it's one that you can appreciate as well. Thank you. Did anybody have any questions about the book or comments about what they liked or didn't like? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. You're the first one brave. Oh, the story is about Martin Luther King. Well, I wish there was some great family history behind that, but the truth is I just made it up. But, you know, I kept thinking about my own maid, Dimitri, growing up, and just the message of love that she tried to pass on. She was a very traditional woman. She didn't, you know, speak up or raise hell or pound her fist. She just went along with the way things were. But I feel like the message and the kindness that she passed along to us, you know, the children, was so wonderful and something that I hope that I can pass along to my own, you know, child as she grows older. But yeah, it just, there are a few things in there. People always ask me about the chocolate pie. There must be some family secret behind that. But, you know, somewhere in my sick little head, it just came up, I guess. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. The question is, how do I relate to Mae Mobley? Well, first, let me just say, Sarah Lee made a comment. There was a misprint in a newspaper saying that my mother had not read The Help, and basically saying that she refused to read it, which is so not true. My mother's read it more times than anybody, and the story is true. Well, kind of true. I didn't get 45 rejections from agents. I got more like 60, which means, you know, that my mother had to listen to me feel sorry for myself on the telephone at least 60 times or more, you know, each rejection kind of pounding me down a little harder. She's been a great supporter. So Mae Mobley is a little white girl, who's being cared for by Abilene, who's a more matronly black woman. And I just loved showing that relationship because what came clear to me was the dynamics between the white children and the black maids, and then the black maids and the white employers were so different. You know, the white children, we looked at them as an extension of our mother. Whether or not they looked at us as an extension of their children, I don't know, because some of us, I know, were royal pains in the ass to be looking after. But, you know, Mae Mobley was just, you know, another white child that was being cared for in an extra special way by a black woman. But my mother was nothing like the mother in the book. My mother was fun and wild, and, you know, she looked after us. She did a good job. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. The question is about research. You know, I realize it's kind of a leap going from 1963 to my childhood, which really would have been the 70s, but not that much changed in Mississippi. I know it changed on the law books. They took the signs down separating the bathrooms, but everything was pretty much the same in the white kitchens. There was no law, you know, that said you had to treat your maid any differently except for, you know, minimum wage, but no one followed that either. So the research I did was just through talking to people, and I actually source a few books that I looked at. Telling Memories is an extraordinary book. A woman, Susan Tucker, actually went out and did the primary research of interviewing black maids and then white women. And she just wrote it down without judgment, word for word. So that was my Bible. But just talking to people, and I have to admit, I did speak to a lot more white people than I did African Americans. It's just not a question, you know, you can easily ask. You can't run up to the first black person you see in Jackson, Mississippi, and say, "Were you a maid? What was that like?" You know, they would think you were crazy. So I had to go a lot on memory. I talked to my grandparents, and I just listened to people's stories. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, the question is about the second book. I told some people earlier today, I have a little nervous breakdown every day about this time. So it's tough because when you write your first book, you're writing it because of the way it makes you, the writer, feel. When you write your second book, you can't help but think what the reader is going to feel. No offense, but I didn't have any of you people looking at me when I wrote the first one. So it is kind of an intimidating position, but I'll tell you, I'm really intrigued by putting a group of women together in Mississippi again, because I have a few more things to say about that place. And it's set during the Great Depression in a really small town. And these women, you know, this was a time in history where there just weren't that many opportunities for women, you know, job-wise. If you weren't married or had a family supporting you, you were very limited on how you earned your income. And I love throwing these women together and taking all the men out of the picture, no offense, and just seeing them, watching them scramble and figure out how they're going to make their lives work. So that is what the story is about. It takes place in a small town right outside of Oxford, Mississippi. And, you know, once again, I'm putting these women to the test and saying, you know, figure it out. So I'm really excited about it. It'll be due out. It's due on my editor's desk January 2011. But I don't know if I'll make that deadline. Yes, ma'am. The question is, were there people like Skeeter? And I'm sure they were. There were. And I've read incredible stories about, you know, women that have taken steps in small ways to change things, to be the anomaly. But I didn't have a particular person in history in mind. I just, you know, it's real easy, I think, for me to have written on this subject 60 years later, you know, and to put a character in there and make her brave and all that. But, you know, Skeeter was fighting the battle while the battle was being fought, whereas I just wrote about it, you know, 60 years later, and it was, I was never as brave as Skeeter, so sometimes I wish I had been, but I'm embarrassed to admit that I really didn't reflect on those times and think about how Dimitri felt until I was about 30 years old. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, you know, it was a very intimate relationship, and you know, I find that the stories just abound of how white children felt about the black women that raised them. But as I was, you know, kind of pouring through the bookstores, and, you know, I just had this little seed of an idea in my mind of the help, I just really couldn't find much information on how the black women felt about raising these white children. And I knew that it had been taken for granted how they must feel. I think Alice Walker might be one of the few that's written about that. That, you know, I'm sure there were cases where, you know, these black maids, you know, they had families of their own. They wanted to go take care of their own children. So I'm sure that there was some affection for the white babies. But it was very interesting for me to examine, did that always go both ways? And sometimes yes, and I would assume sometimes no. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. How long have I lived in Atlanta? 2 years. We left New York 2 years ago. I was there for about 16 years. I don't know Atlanta well enough to write about it. I know Mississippi, and it's such a complex, stagnant place that I love, by the way. I think that's where my stories will be for a while. Oh, thank you. You know, I say this in the back of the book, and I can't say it enough. I really don't ever pretend to think that I knew exactly how these black women felt. And, you know, I don't think that's anything that a white woman on the other end of a black woman's paycheck can know fully. But I do think it's important, you know, as human beings, as part of the human race, to always try to imagine what it feels like to be in someone else's shoes, whether we look up to that person, you know, wherever that person is in life, at whatever station they hold. It's just important to realize that, you know, I say it again and again, you know, we're all just people. We all have so much more in common. And I think we forget that as we get caught up in our day-to-day lives. So thank you. I'm glad that she related to the book. And just as an aside, my own maid, who is an African-American who grew up in Birmingham, those were her words exactly. She said, I liked the book, but I didn't like the book. It just hit a little too close to home. And I get that. Are we doing okay on time? Okay, you give me a... Okay, a few more questions. Yes, ma'am. The question is about the timing, I think, of the book and Obama as our president. I don't know. It's just, it just turned out that way. I never planned it like that, but golly, I mean, it's just amazing. Look how far we've come. I have to tell you, I'm so proud that this book is set in Mississippi, not because of, you know, all the terrible things you hear about Mississippi, but because it just shows how capable of change we are as Southerners, as Americans. I really don't think that's something that every country can claim about themselves. So, yeah, I don't quite know how to answer the question, except I'm just very proud of our country. Any other questions or comments? I see somebody pointing, but I can't see. Oh, up. I'm sorry. I forgot about you. Yes. The question is, how long did it take me to write? And it took me about 5 years. I started it. I had taken time off of work. It was 2001. I know exactly the day I started it because I'd taken time off of work. And I was living at home or in my apartment downtown in New York, and it was September 9th. And then September 10th, I wrote a day on the story I was working on that was evidently really bad. The next day was September 11th, just completely wiped myself clean because I couldn't think about anything except for my family. We couldn't call them. We had no phones, no landline, no cell phone, no internet. Couldn't even tell our families that we were doing okay. And, you know, the first voice that came in my head was Dimitri's. So like a lot of writers do, I started, you know, I comforted myself by writing in her voice. So, you know, 5 years later, I finally finished it. And then, you know, I had been shopping it around to agents and, you know, rejection after rejection. And I have to say, many of those rejections I truly think I deserved. But what they did is put, you know, a hot fire under my ass to make me revise it and not take no for an answer, because I'm just not that kind of person, as you can imagine Mrs. Kemp would tell you as well. I every time I'd get another rejection, you know, I'd cry and whine, and then I'd go back to the books and say, how can I make this better? And I encourage any writer out there who hasn't gotten an agent yet, you know, just keep trying. No one can say whether your work is good or bad. Just keep trying. If it's good, there's some agent out there that will take it. Even if it's not good, there's probably an agent that will take it. Okay. All right. Are we good? I think I had such a nice time talking to everybody. Is there one more question? Okay, sorry. Yes, ma'am. I'm asked this question a lot, and I think the question is, are African Americans taking the book well or liking it? And I really can't speak on behalf of any demographic, not even my own. You know, I can tell you that people usually don't approach me or email me unless they like the book. Occasionally I'll get that crazy email from that person, all in capital letters, saying, pantyhose were not invented. And I apologize. We changed that for the paperback, by the way. And they were invented, mind you. It's just that these women evidently weren't wearing them. But, you know, the African-American women that have read the book and approached me usually do so because they did relate to it. So I can't say for sure, but you know, I encourage dialogue. If anything, I hope, whether you like the book or don't like the book, I hope that it makes people talk about an issue that might not have been talked about much before. All right. Thank you so much.